meant to be. That I'm nothing more than a desperate, wriggling insect destiny forgot to squash. Is Lisa's suicide why you came out of hiding after all this time? Sam levels her gaze at me. What do you think? Yes, because it rattled you as much as it did me. Sam stays silent. I'm right, aren't I?
Maybe, she says.
And you wanted to finally see me in person, because you were curious about what I was like.
Oh, I already know everything about you, Sam says.
She leans back onto the sofa, finally allowing herself to get more comfortable. She crosses her legs, the left boot thrown casually over her right knee. Her arms unlock from her sides, spreading like wings across the cushions. I perform a similar unfolding. My arms fall from around my chest as I lean forward in my chair. You'd be surprised. Sam arches one of her brows. Both have been drawn on with black eyeliner, and the movement exposes a few downy hairs beneath the dark smudge.
An unexpected challenge from Miss Quincy Carpenter.
It's not a challenge, I say. Just a fact. I've got secrets.
We all have secrets, Sam replies. But are you more than the young Martha Stewart you pretend to be on your blog? That's the real question.
How do you know I'm pretending?
Because you're a final girl. It's different for us.
I'm not a final girl, I say. I really never have been. I'm just me. Now, I'm not going to lie and say I don't think about what happened. I do, but not a lot. I've moved past that. Sam looks like she doesn't believe me.
Both fake brows are now raised. So, you're telling me you've been cured by the therapeutic value of baking?
It helps, I say.
Then prove it.
Prove it?
Yeah, Sam says. Bake something.
Right now?
Sure. Sam stands, stretches, hauls me out of my chair. Show me the real you.
7. Baking is a science, as rigorous as chemistry or physics. There are rules that must be followed. Too much of one thing and not enough of another can lead to ruin. I find comfort in this. Outside, the world is an unruly place where men prowl with sharpened knives. In baking, there is only order. That's why Quincy Sweets exists. When I graduated college with a marketing degree and moved to New York, I still thought of myself as a victim. So did everyone else. Baking seemed the only way to change that. I wanted to pour my runny, sloshing existence into a human-shaped mold and crank up the heat, emerging soft, springy, and new. So far, it's working. In the kitchen, I spread twin lines of bowls across the counter, sized according to what they contain. The biggest ones hold the base, powdery mounds of flour and sugar heaped like snowdrifts. Medium bowls are for the glue, water, eggs, butter. In the smallest bowls are the flavors, the tiniest amounts packing the largest punch, pumpkin puree and orange zest, cinnamon and cranberry. Sam stares at the array of ingredients, uncertain.
What are you going to bake?
We are going to bake orange pumpkin loaf. I want Sam to witness firsthand the formula behind baking and to experience its safety. I want her to see how it's helped me become more than just a girl screaming through the woods away from Pine Cottage. If she believes it, then maybe it's actually true. Sam remains still, looking first at me and then at our surroundings. I think the kitchen is cozy, done up in soothing greens and blues. There's a vase of daisies on the windowsill and kitschy potholders hanging from the walls.
The appliances are state-of-the-art, but with a retro design. Sam eyes it all with barely concealed terror. She has the look of a feral child dragged suddenly into civilization. "Do you know how to bake?" I ask.
"No," Sam says. "I microwave."
Then she laughs, a raucous, throaty one that fills the kitchen. I like the sound. When it's just me in the kitchen, all is silent. "It's easy," I tell her. "Trust me." I position Sam before one row of bowls and take my place before the other. I then show her, step by step, how to fold the butter and sugar together, combine them with the flour, water, and eggs, layer in the flavors one at a time. Sam forms the batter the same way she talks, in short, haphazard bursts. Tufts of flour and blots of pumpkin rise from her bowl.
Am I doing this right?"
"Almost," I say. "You need to be more gentle."
"You sound like all my ex-boyfriends," Sam jokes,
even though she's starting to follow my advice and mix the ingredients with slightly less force. The results are immediate.
"Hey, it's working."
"Slow and steady wins the race. That's the 10th commandment on my blog."
"You should write a cookbook," Sam says. "Baking for idiots."
"I've thought about it. Just a regular cookbook, though."
"What about a book about Pine Cottage?"
I stiffen at the sound of those two words pushed together. Individually, they have no power over me. Pine, cottage, nothing but harmless words. But when combined, they obtain the sharpness of the knife he shoved into my shoulder and stomach. If I blink, I know I'll see Janelle emerging from the trees, still technically alive but already dead. So I keep my eyes open, staring at the batter thickening in the bowl in front of me. "It would be an awfully short book," I say.
"Oh, yeah."
There's a false ring to Sam's voice, as if she's trying to make it sound like she's only just now considering my memory loss.
"Right."
She's staring too, although at me and not at her bowl. I feel her gaze on my cheek, as warm as the afternoon sun coming through the kitchen window. I get the uneasy sense she's testing me somehow, that I'll fail if I turn to meet her stare. I continue to look at the bread batter, thick and glistening in the bottom of my bowl. "Did you read Lisa's book?" I ask.
"Nah," Sam says. "You?"
"No." I don't know why I lie, which is itself a lie. I do know. It's to keep Sam slightly off balance. I bet she assumes I've read Lisa's book cover to cover, which I have. There's nothing as boring as being predictable. "And the two of you never met?" I say.
"Lisa never got the pleasure," Sam says. "You?"
"We talked on the phone about how to deal with trauma, what people expect of us. It wasn't quite like meeting in person."
"And sure as hell not like baking together."
Sam nudges my hip with hers and gives another laugh. Whatever test she was giving me, I think I've passed. "It's time to put these in the oven," I announce. I slide my batter into a loaf pan using a spatula. Sam simply tips her bowl over the pan, but her aim is off, and batter spills onto the counter.
"Shit," she says. "Where can I get one of those flat things?"
"You mean a spatula? In there." I point to one of the counter drawers behind her. She tugs the handle of the one beneath it. The locked drawer. My drawer. Inside, something rattles.
"What's in here?"
"Don't touch that." I sound more panicked than I intend to, my voice slightly dusted with anger. My hand flutters to my neck, feeling for the key, as if it had somehow magically found its way into the drawer's lock. It's still there, of course, flat against my chest. "It's recipes," I say, calming. "My top secret stash."
"Sorry," Sam says as she lets go of the drawer handle.
No one can see them, I add.
Sure, I get it.
Sam raises both hands. Her jacket sleeve rides down her wrist, fully revealing the tattoo there. It's a single word etched in black.
Survivor. The letters are capitalized. The font is bold. It's both declaration and dare.
Go on, it says. Just try to fuck with me.
An hour later, all the cupcakes from yesterday are decorated, and two orange pumpkin loaves sit cooling atop the oven. Sam surveys the results with weary pride, a smudge of flour across her cheek like war paint.
So now what? She says.
I begin to arrange the cupcakes on chunky fiesta ware, their black icing popping against the pale green of the plates.
Now we design a table setting for both desserts and photograph it for the website.
I meant about us, Sam says. We met, we talked, we baked. It was magical.
So now what?
That depends on why you came here, I say. Is it really just because of what happened to Lisa?
Isn't that enough?
You could have called. Or emailed.
I wanted to see you in person, Sam says. After learning what Lisa had done, I wanted to see how you were doing.
And how am I doing?
I can't tell. Care to give me a hint?
I busy myself with the cupcakes, trying out different arrangements as Sam stands behind me.
Quincy.
I'm sad, okay? I say, whirling around to face her. Lisa's suicide makes me sad.
I'm not.
Sam examines her hands as she says it, digging batter out from under her fingernails.
I'm pissed off. After all she survived, that's how she died? It makes me mad.
Although it's exactly the same thing I had said to Jeff last night, irritation ripples over me. I turn back to the display.
Don't be mad at Lisa.
I'm not, Sam says. I'm pissed off at myself. For never reaching out to her. Or to you.
Maybe if I had, I...
Could have prevented it? I say.
Join the club.
Although my back is still turned to Sam, I know she's staring again. This time a faint cold spot blunts the heat of her gaze. Curiosity left unarticulated. I want nothing more than to tell her about the email Lisa sent me before she died. It would be a relief to talk about it, to let Sam shoulder some of the burden of my possibly misplaced guilt. But it's partly guilt that has brought her to my door. I'm not about to add to it, especially if this visit is some unspoken rite of atonement.
What happened to Lisa sucks, she says. I feel like shit knowing that we, actually, might have been able to help her. I don't want the same thing happening to you.
I'm not suicidal, I say.
But I wouldn't have known it if you were. If you ever need help or something, tell me. I'll do the same for you. We need to look out for each other. So you can talk to me about what happened. You know, if you ever need to.
Don't worry, I say. I'm happy.
Good.
The word rings hollow, as if she doesn't believe me.
That's good to hear.
Really, I am. The website's going well. Jeff is fantastic.
Will I be allowed to meet this Jeff?
It's a nesting doll question, concealing other unspoken ones inside. If I crack open, will I meet Jeff, I'll find, do you like me? Out of which pops, are we becoming friends? Inside that is the most compact, most important question, the heart of the matter. Are we the same?
Of course, I say, answering them all at once. You have to stay for dinner.
I finish the table setting, the cupcakes angled so their frosted spiders will fill the frame. For the background, I've chosen a swath of fabric with a bold 50s pattern and vintage ceramic pumpkins picked up at a flea market.
Cute, Sam says, the wrinkling of her nose indicating it's not a compliment.
In the baking blog biz, cute sells.
We stand shoulder to shoulder, studying the display. Despite all those minute adjustments, it's still not right. There's something missing. Some intangible spark I've neglected to include.
It's too perfect, Sam announces.
It's not, I say, when of course it is. The whole display is flat, lifeless. Everything is so pristine, the cupcakes might as well be fake. They certainly look that way. Plastic frosting atop a foam base.
What would you do differently?
Sam approaches the display with an index finger on her chin, lost in thought. She then goes to work, tearing through it like Godzilla stomping Tokyo. Some of the plates are cleared of cupcakes and hastily stacked. A ceramic pumpkin is knocked on its side, and a napkin is crumpled and casually tossed, bouncing into the middle of the scene. Wrappers are torn from three cupcakes and dropped into the mix. The once pristine display is now chaotic. It resembles a table after a wildly entertaining dinner party, messy and satisfying and real.
It's perfect.
I grab my camera and start taking pictures, zooming in on the disheveled cupcakes. Behind them sits an uneven stack of Fiesta ware, some bearing gobs of black icing, dark against the green. Sam grabs a cupcake and takes a gargantuan bite as crumbs drip and cherry filling oozes.
Take my picture!
I hesitate for reasons she can't begin to understand.
I don't put pictures of people on the blog, I say. Only food.
Nor do I take pictures of people, even ones not intended for my website. No Lisa-esque selfies for me. Not since Pine Cottage.
Just this once, Sam says, faking a pout. For me?
Hesitantly, I look into the camera's viewfinder and suck in a breath. It's like peering into a crystal ball and seeing not my future, but my past. I see Janelle, standing in front of Pine Cottage, striking wacky poses with her too many suitcases. I didn't notice the similarity earlier, but now it's obvious. While Sam and Janelle don't physically resemble each other, they share the same spirit, vivid and unapologetic and startlingly alive.
Something wrong? Sam says.
No. I click the shutter, taking a single picture.
Nothing's wrong.
Sam hurries to my side, nudging me until I show her the photograph.
I like it, she says. You definitely need to put it up on your blog.
I tell her that I will, which pleases her, even though I plan to delete the picture the first chance I get. Next, it's time to arrange and photograph the pumpkin bread. I let Sam saw away at one of the lobes, the uneven slices unfolding off it like pages torn from a book. The ceramic pumpkins are replaced with vintage teacups I found a week earlier in the West Village. I fill them with coffee, varying the amounts in each. When a splash of coffee hits the table, I leave it there, letting it pool around the base of a teacup. Sam finishes things by lifting the cup and taking a long, slurping sip. Her lipstick leaves a mark on the brim. A ruby kiss, mysterious and seductive. She stands back to let me photograph it. I click away, taking more pictures than necessary, drawn to the chaos. 8. Dinner time arrives in a panicked whirl of preparation and last-minute details. I whip up linguine with the homemade puttanesca sauce Jeff's mother taught me how to make. There's salad, freshly baked breadsticks, wine from actual bottles, all perfectly laid out on the rough-hewn dining room table we bought the previous summer in Red Hook.
Jeff comes home to find Rosemary Clooney standards drifting from the living room stereo, and me clad in the mid-50s party dress I felt compelled to change into, my face pink and gleaming. God knows what's going through his mind. Definitely confusion. Perhaps worry that I've gone a little overboard, which I have. But I hope there's pride in the mix, too, at what I've accomplished. At the fact that after so many crowded, informal meals with his family, I finally have a guest. Then Sam emerges from the dining room with her face scrubbed of flour and a fresh coat of lipstick, and I know exactly what Jeff is thinking. Concern mixed with suspicion, tinged with surprise. "Jeff, this is Sam," I announce. "Samantha Boyd?" Jeff says, more to me than to her. Sam smiles and offers her hand. I prefer Sam. "Sure. Hi, Sam." The situation has jolted Jeff so much that he almost forgets to return Sam's handshake. When he does, it's weak. More hand than shake. "Quincy, can I talk to you for a sec?" We go to the kitchen, where I quickly brief him on the afternoon's events, finishing with, "I hope you don't mind that I asked her to stay for dinner."
"It's certainly a surprise," he says.
"Yes, it happened very suddenly."
"You should have called me."
"You would have tried to talk me out of it," I say. Jeff ignores the remark, mostly because he knows it's true. "I just think it's very strange that she suddenly showed up like this. That's not normal, Quinn."
"You're sounding a bit too suspicious, Mr. Lawyer."
"I'd just feel better knowing more about why she's here."
"I'm still trying to figure that out," I say.
"Then why did you invite her to dinner?"
I want to tell him about that afternoon. How for a moment Sam was so much like Janelle that it took my breath away. But he wouldn't understand. No one would. "I kind of feel sorry for her," I say. "After all that she's been through, I think she just might need a friend."
"Fine," Jeff says. "If you're cool with all this, then so am I."
Yet the shadow of a scowl crossing his face tells me that he's not entirely cool with it. Still, we go back to the dining room, where Sam politely pretends that we just weren't talking about her.
"Everything good?" she says.
I smile so wide my cheeks hurt. "Perfect. Let's eat." During the meal, I play hostess, serving the food and pouring the wine, trying hard to ignore that Jeff is talking to Sam like she's one of his clients, genial but probing. Jeff's a conversational dentist that way, extracting what needs to be removed.
"Quinn tells me you vanished for a few years," he says.
"I like to think of it as laying low."
"What was that like?"
"Peaceful. No one knowing who I was. No one knowing all the bad things that happened to me."
"Sounds more like being a fugitive," Jeff says.
"I guess," Sam replies. "Only I didn't do anything wrong, remember?"
"So why hide?"
"Why not?" When Jeff can't think of a good response, silence ensues, broken occasionally by the sound of cutlery scraping against plates. It makes me nervous, and before I know it, my wine glass is empty. I refill it before offering more to the others.
"Sam, refill?"
She seems to intuit my nervousness and smiles to put me at ease.
"Sure," she says, gulping down the rest of the wine in her glass just so I can pour more into it.
I turn to Jeff. "More wine?"
"I'm good," he tells me.
To Sam, he says,
"And where have you been living these days?"
"Here and there." The same answer she had given me. One that doesn't satisfy Jeff. He lowers his fork to give Sam a cross-examination stare.
"Where, exactly?"
"No place you would have heard of," Sam says.
"I've heard of all 50 states."
Jeff flashes a friendly smile, I can even recite most of their capitals.
I think Sam wants to keep it a secret, I say, in case she wants to return there and live in anonymity.
Across the table, Sam gives me a grateful nod. I'm looking out for her, just like she said we should do. Even if, in this case at least, I'm just as curious as Jeff.
I'm sure she'll tell us eventually, I add. Right, Sam?
Maybe. The hardness in Sam's voice makes it clear there'll be no maybe. Yet she tries to sandpaper her tone by adding a joke. It depends on how good dessert is.
It doesn't matter anyway, Jeff says. What matters is that the two of you finally got the chance to connect. I know it means a lot to Quinn. She was really broken up about what happened with Lisa.
Me too, Sam says. As soon as I heard about it, I decided to come here and finally talk to her.
Jeff tilts his head. With his shaggy hair and big brown eyes, he looks like a spaniel faced with a bone, hungry and alert.
So, you knew Quinn was in New York?
Over the years, I kept tabs on both her and Lisa.
Interesting. For what reason?
Curiosity, I suppose. I liked knowing they were doing okay. Or at least thinking they were.
Jeff nods, looks down at his plate, pushes the linguine from one side to the other with his fork. Eventually, he says,
"Is this your first time in Manhattan?"
"No, I've been here a few times before."
"When was your last visit?"
"Decades ago," Sam says, "when I was a kid."
"So, before all that stuff happened at the hotel?"
"Yeah."
Sam gazes at him from across the table, eyes narrowed, on the razor's edge of a glare.
"Before all that stuff."
Jeff pretends not to notice the sarcastic spin placed on that last word.
"So it's been a while, I guess."
"It has."
"And Quincy's well-being is the only reason you came here?"
I reach out to pat Jeff's hand, a silent signal that he's out of bounds, taking things too far. He does the same thing to me when we're visiting my mother and I get too argumentative about her views on, everything.
"What other reason could there be?" Sam says.
"I suppose there could be plenty," Jeff replies, my hand still heavy over his.
"Maybe you're seeking some publicity in the wake of Lisa's death.
Maybe you need money."
"That's not why I'm here."
"I hope not. I hope you only came here to check in on Quinn."
"I suppose that was always Lisa's wish," Sam says, "to have the three of us meet, you know, and help one another."
The mood has irrevocably shifted. Suspicion hovers over the table, humid and sour. Impulsively, I raise my glass. It's almost empty again, a thin circle of red swirling around its bottom.
"I think we should make a toast," I announce. "To Lisa. Although the three of us never got the chance to meet, I think she's here in spirit. I also think she'd be pleased to see at least two of us together at last."
"To Lisa," Sam says, playing along. I slosh more wine into my glass, then more into Sam's, even though it's still half full. When our glasses clink over the table, it's too hard, too loud, the crystal a hair's breadth from cracking. A wave of Pinot Noir breaches the edge of my glass, splashing onto the salad and breadsticks below. The wine seeps into the bread, leaving behind splotches of red. I let out a nervous giggle. Sam pops out one of her shotgun blast laughs. Jeff, not amused, gives me a look he sometimes whips out during awkward work functions. The "are you drunk" look. I'm not. Well, not yet. But I can see why he thinks I am.
"So, what do you do for a living, Sam?" he asks.
She shrugs. "A little of this, a little of that."
"I see," Jeff says.
"I'm between jobs at the moment."
"I see,"
Jeff says again. I take another sip of wine.
And you're a lawyer.
Coming from Sam, it sounds like an accusation.
I am, Jeff says. A public defender.
Interesting. That all types of people come your way.
They certainly do.
Sam leans back in her chair, one arm crossed over her stomach. The other grips her wine glass, holding it close to her lips. Smiling over the rim, she says,
And are all your clients criminals?
Jeff mirrors Sam's stance, reclined in his chair, clenching his wine glass. I watch the two of them face off, the half-eaten meal heavy and unsettled in the pit of my stomach.
My clients are innocent until proven guilty, Jeff says.
But most of them are, right? Proven guilty?
I suppose you could say that.
How does that make you feel?
Knowing the guy sitting next to you in court in a borrowed suit did all those things he's accused of.
Are you asking me if I feel guilty about it?
Do you?
No, Jeff says.
I feel noble knowing that I'm one of the few people giving that guy in the borrowed suit the benefit of the doubt.
But what if he did something really bad? Sam asks.
How bad are we talking about? Jeff says. Murder?
Worse. I know where Sam's going with this, and my stomach clenches even more. I put a hand over it, rubbing slightly.
It doesn't get much worse than murder, Jeff says, also knowing what Sam's up to and not caring. He'll gladly follow her to the edge of an argument. I've seen it happen before.
Have you represented a murderer?
I have, Jeff says. In fact, I'm doing so right now.
And do you like it?
It doesn't matter if I like it. It needs to be done.
What if the guy killed several people?
He still needs defending, Jeff says.
What if it's the guy who killed all those people at the Nightlight Inn?
Or the guy who did all that shit at Pine Cottage?
Sam's anger is palpable now, a heat pulsing across the table. Her voice picks up speed, each subsequent word getting harder, rougher.
Knowing all of that, would you still happily sit next to that motherfucker and try to keep him out of jail?
Jeff remains motionless, save for a slight working of his jaw. His eyes never leave Sam. He doesn't even blink.
It must be convenient, he says, to have something to blame for everything that went wrong in your life.
Jeff. My throat is parched, my voice soft and easy to ignore.
Stop. Quinn could do that.
God knows she has every right to,
but she doesn't, because she's managed to put it behind her. She's strong like that. She's not some,
Jeff, please,
helpless victim who skipped out on her family and friends instead of trying to move past something that happened more than a decade ago.
Enough!
I leap from my seat, tipping my wine glass, its contents gushing over the table. I sop it up with my napkin, white fabric turning red.
Jeff, bedroom, now.
We stand by the closed door, facing each other, our bodies a study in contrasts. Jeff is calm and loose, arms at his sides. Mine are a straitjacket across my chest, which lifts and falls in exasperation.
You didn't need to be so harsh.
After what she said to me? I think I did, Quinn.
You have to admit, you kind of started it.
By being curious?
By being suspicious, I say. You were giving her the third degree out there. This isn't court. She's not one of your clients, Jeff!
My voice is too loud, ringing off the walls. Jeff and I both look to the door, pausing to find out if Sam heard us.
I'm sure she did.
Even if she has managed to miss my increasingly shrill tone, it's obvious we're again talking about her.
I was asking her pretty rational questions, Jeff says, lowering his voice to make up for my volume.
Don't you think she's being evasive?
She doesn't want to talk about this stuff. I can't blame her.
That still gave her no right to talk to me like that. As if I'm the one who attacked her. She's sensitive. Bullshit. She was egging me on. She was defending herself, I say. She's not an enemy, Jeff. She's a friend. Or at least she can be.
Do you even want to be friends with her? Until yesterday, you seemed perfectly happy having nothing to do with this final girl stuff. So what's changed?
Other than Lisa Milner's suicide?
A sigh from Jeff. I understand how much it's upset you. I know you're sad and disappointed about what happened. But why this sudden interest in becoming friends with Sam? You don't even know her, Quinn.
I know her. She went through the same thing I did, Jeff. I know exactly who she is.
I'm just worried that if you two get close, you'll start dwelling on what happened to you. And you've moved past it.
Jeff means well. I know this. And living with me isn't always easy.
I know this, too. But that doesn't keep his comment from getting me riled up even more.
My friends were slaughtered, Jeff. That's not something I'll ever move past.
You know I didn't mean it like that.
I lift my chin, defiant in my anger.
Then what did you mean?
That you've become more than a victim, Jeff says. That your life, our life, isn't defined by that night.
I don't want that to change.
My being nice to Sam isn't going to change anything.
And it's not like I have a whole army of friends beating down the front door.
This isn't something I plan to admit. My loneliness is something I generally keep from Jeff. I smile sunnily when he comes home from work and asks me how my day was. Fine, I always say, when in fact my days are often a lonely blur. Long afternoons spent baking in isolation, sometimes talking to the oven just to hear the sound of my voice. Instead of friends, I have acquaintances. Former classmates and co-workers. Ones with husbands and kids and office jobs that aren't conducive to regular contact. Ones I purposefully kept at a distance until they became nothing more substantial than occasional text messages or emails.
I really need this, Jeff, I say.
Jeff grips my shoulders, kneading them. He looks into my eyes, seeing something out of place, something unspoken.
What aren't you telling me?
I got an email, I say.
From Sam?
Lisa. She sent it an hour before she...
offed herself, I want to say. Finished what Stephen Liebman didn't get the chance to do.
Passed away.
What did it say?
I recite the email word for word, the text etched into my memory.
Why would she do that?
Jeff says, as if I somehow have an answer. I don't know. I'll never know. But for some reason, she was thinking about me right before she died. And all I can think about is the fact that if I had seen that email in time, I could have possibly saved her. Tears form, hot in the corners of my eyes. I try to blink them back. To no avail. Jeff pulls me to him, my head against his chest, his arms tight across my back.
Jesus, Quinn. I'm so sorry. I didn't know.
You had no way of knowing.
But you can't let yourself think you're responsible for Lisa's death.
I don't, I say. But I do think I missed my chance to help her. I don't want to do the same thing with Sam. I know she's rough around the edges. But I think she needs me.
Jeff sighs a long exhalation of defeat. I'll play nice, he says. I promise.
We kiss and make up, tears salty on my lips. I wipe them away while Jeff lets go of me, jiggling his arms to release the tension. I give my shirt a tug and smooth out the tear-stained spot I left on his. Then we're out of the bedroom, moving down the hall with hands entwined, a unified front. In the dining room, we find the table unoccupied, Sam's chair pushed away from it,
She's not in the kitchen either. Or the living room. In the foyer, the spot by the door where her knapsack sat is now an empty patch of floor. Once again, Samantha Boyd has vanished.
9. My phone rings at 3 a.m., yanking me from a nightmare of running through a forest. Running from him. Tripping and screaming, tree branches reaching out to circle my wrists. I'm still running even after I wake, my legs thrashing beneath the covers. The phone keeps ringing, an urgent beep slicing the silence of the room. Jeff, the heaviest of sleepers, trained only to wake to the Pavlovian bell of his alarm clock, doesn't stir. To keep it that way, I cover the screen when I grab the phone, blocking its glow. I peek through my fingers in search of the caller's identity. Unknown. Hello? I whisper as I slide out of bed and rush to the door. Quincy? It's Sam, her voice hard to hear over the din surrounding her. There's chatter and yelling and the harried clack of fingers on keyboards. Sam? I'm in the hallway now. Eyes bleary in the darkness, brain swimming in a soup of confusion. Where did you disappear to? Why are you calling me so late? I'm sorry. I really am. But something's happened. I think she's going to say something about him. Most likely because of the nightmare, which lingers sticky on my skin like drying perspiration. I brace myself to hear her tell me that he's resurfaced, as I always knew he would. It doesn't matter that he's dead, that I gladly watched him die. Instead, Sam says, I need your help.
What's wrong? What happened?
I was sort of arrested.
What?
The word echoes down the hallway, waking Jeff. From the bedroom, I hear the squeak of the mattress as he bolts upright and calls my name. On the phone, Sam says, Please come get me. Central Park Precinct. Bring Jeff. She hangs up before I get the chance to ask her how she knew my phone number. Jeff and I take a cab to the precinct, which is situated just south of the reservoir. I've jogged past it dozens of times, always slightly confused by its mix of old and new. It consists of low-slung brick buildings, around since the park's birth, bisected by a modern atrium that glows from within. Every time I see it, I think of a snow globe, a Dickensian village encased in glass. Inside, I ask to see Samantha Boyd. The desk sergeant on duty is a ruddy-faced Irishman with love handles jiggling under his uniform. He checks the computer and says, We haven't brought in anyone by that name, miss.
But she told me she was here.
How long ago was this?
20 minutes, I say as I adjust the half-tucked blouse bunched at my waist.
Jeff and I had dressed in a hurry, with me throwing on the same clothes I had worn that afternoon. Jeff slipped into jeans and a long-sleeved T-shirt, his hair jutting off his head in wild thatches. Officer Love Handles frowns at the computer.
I've got nothing.
Maybe she's already been released, Jeff says, all but announcing his wishful thinking. Is that a possibility?
She'd still be in the system. Maybe she gave you the wrong precinct. Or maybe you misheard her.
It was this one. I tell him, I'm sure of it.
I scan the open expanse of the precinct. High-ceilinged and bright, it looks more like a modern train depot than a police station. There's a sleek staircase, state-of-the-art lighting, the staccato click of footsteps on the polished floors.
Have any women been brought in recently? Jeff asks.
One,
the desk sergeant says, still studying the computer.
35 minutes ago.
What's her name?
I'm afraid that's confidential.
I look to Jeff, hopeful. It could be her.
I then look to the desk sergeant, pleading, "Can we see her?"
"It's not really allowed."
Jeff pulls out his wallet and flashes his work ID. He explains, in his unfailingly polite way, that he's a public defender, that we're not here to cause trouble, that a friend of ours claimed to be in police custody at this precinct. "Please," I say to the desk sergeant, "I'm worried about her." He relents and passes us into the care of another officer, this one bigger, stronger, devoid of love handles. He guides us into the heart of the precinct. The room gives off a jittery, caffeinated vibe. All that institutional lighting brightening what's technically the dead of night. Sam is there, after all, cuffed to a booking desk. "That's her," I tell our escort. He grabs my arm when I try to surge forward, keeping me in place. I call her name. "Sam!" The cop at the booking desk stands, asks her a question. I can read his lips. "Do you know that woman?" When Sam nods, the cop holding me back gently walks me to her, his hand like a vise on my arm. He lets go once I'm within arm's length of Sam's booking officer. "Sam?" I say. "What happened?" Her cop gives her another look, forehead creasing.
"Are you sure you know this woman?"
"Yes," I say, answering for her. "Her name is Samantha Boyd, and I'm sure whatever happened is simply a misunderstanding."
"That's not the name she gave the arresting officer."
"What do you mean?" The cop coughs while shuffling through paperwork.
"Says here that her name's Tina Stone."
I look to Sam. The late hour has made her cheeks puffy and red. Her eyeliner is smudged in spots, streaks of blackness that bleed into the circles beneath her eyes. "Is this true?"
"Yeah," she says with a shrug. "I changed my name a while back."
"So your name is really Tina Stone?"
"Now it is. Legally. You know, just because."
"I do know. I thought about doing the same thing a year after Pine Cottage, for the same reason Sam has no need to articulate. Because I was tired of strangers vaguely recognizing it when I was introduced to them. Because I hated the way their features froze, if only for a second, when their memories clicked. Because it made me sick knowing my name and his will forever be associated. Coop ultimately talked me out of it. He said I should hold on to my name as a stubborn point of pride. Changing it wouldn't separate the name Quincy Carpenter from the horrors of Pine Cottage. Keeping it could, if I moved on and made something of myself. Something beyond being the lucky one who lived when so many others had not. "Now that we've got the name thing cleared up," Jeff says, "can someone tell me what she's been accused of?"
"Are you her attorney?" the cop asks.
Jeff sighs.
"I guess." "Miss Stone," the cop says, "faces charges of third-degree assault on a police officer and resisting arrest."
The details come in pieces from both Sam and the booking officer. Jeff, calm and collected, asks the questions. I struggle to keep up, head pivoting between the three of them, my brain buzzing from lack of sleep. From what I'm able to gather, Sam, now also known as Tina Stone, went to a bar on the Upper West Side after leaving my apartment. After a few drinks, she went outside for a smoke, encountering a husband and wife in mid-argument. It was heated, according to Sam. Things got physical. When the man shoved the woman, she stepped in. "I was breaking up a fight," she tells us.
"You attacked him," the cop counters.
Both agree on one thing, that Sam ultimately punched the man. He called the police while Sam asked the woman if she was okay, if fights like this were a regular thing, if the man had ever hit her. When a pair of cops arrived, Sam bolted across Central Park West, vanishing into the park itself. The cops followed, caught up, brought out the cuffs. That's when Sam resisted.
"They were arresting me for no goddamn reason," she says.
"You hit a man," the cop says.
She sniffs. "I was trying to help. He looked like he was about to beat the shit out of that woman. He probably would have, too, if I hadn't done something about it."
Frustrated by the injustice of it all, Sam's words, not mine, she took a swing at one of the cops, knocking off his hat and prompting her arrest.
"It was only his hat, for God's sake," she mutters in conclusion. "It's not like I hurt him or anything."
"It appeared to him like you wanted to," the booking officer says. "That harm certainly seemed to be your intent."
"Let's talk this through," Jeff says. "She's only being charged with what happened in the park, correct?"
The cop nods. "The man she punched declined to press charges."
"Then clearly we can work something out." Jeff pulls the cop aside. They confer by the wall, their voices low but still loud enough for me to hear. I stand next to Sam, my hand on her shoulder, fingers digging into the soft leather of her jacket. She doesn't bother trying to listen in. She simply stares straight ahead, grinding her teeth.
"This all sounds to me like a big misunderstanding," Jeff tells the cop.
"Not to me," the cop replies.
"It's clear she shouldn't have done what she did. But she was trying to help that woman, and emotions were high, and she got a little wild."
"You're saying the charges should be dropped?"
The booking officer looks our way. I give him a smile, hoping it will somehow persuade him. As if seeing perky, harmless me at Sam's side will tip the scales in her favor.
"I'm saying she shouldn't have been charged in the first place," Jeff says. "If you knew what she's been through, you'd understand why she acted that way."
The cop's face is a blank.
"Then tell me what happened to her."
Jeff whispers something to him that I can't fully make out. I catch only random words. One of them is nightlight. Another is murders. The booking officer turns to look at Sam again. This time, his eyes contain a potent mix of curiosity and pity. I've seen that look 1,000 times before. It's the look of someone realizing he's facing a final girl. He whispers something to Jeff. Jeff whispers back. This continues a few more seconds until they shake hands, and Jeff walks briskly toward us.
"Grab your things," he tells Sam. "You're free to go."
Outside, the three of us idle in the courtyard just beyond the precinct's glass front wall, the Irish desk sergeant watching us from his post. A chilly breeze courses through the park, nipping at my ears and nose. I was in too much of a hurry when we left to think of bringing a sweater and now hug myself for warmth. Sam zips her leather jacket all the way to her chin, the collar popped. The knapsack is strapped to her back. Its weight makes her list sideways as she says, "Thank you for helping me in there. After the shit I said tonight, I wouldn't have blamed you for letting me rot in a holding cell."
"You're welcome," Jeff says. "I'm not such a bad guy now, am I?"
He gives us a pleased-with-himself grin. I turn away. Although I know I should be grateful, a rash of annoyance creeps across my skin. Sam, though, is grateful. She thrusts out her hand, her survivor tattoo peeking from her sleeve. Jeff looks to me as he shakes it, sensing something is wrong. I refuse to meet his eye. Instead of a handshake, Sam gives me a quick hug.
"Quincy, it was good to finally meet you."
"Wait, you're leaving?"
"I think I've caused enough trouble," she says. "I only wanted to see how you were doing. Now I have my answer. You're doing great. I'm happy for you, babe."
"But where will you go?"
"Here and there," Sam says. "Take care of yourself, okay?"
She starts to walk away. Or maybe she only pretends to, knowing I'll stop her. It's hard to tell, with the knapsack giving her a slow, uneven gait. Still, I know I can't let her slip away again. Not like this.
Sam, wait, I say. I know you don't have a place to stay.
Wind whips hair across her face as she turns around.
Don't sweat it. I'll be okay.
You will, I tell her. Because you're coming home with us. 10. The minute we get home, Jeff and I confer in the bedroom, the door closed, our voices emerging in exhausted half-whispers so Sam can't hear us from the living room.
She can stay one night, Jeff says.
The night's almost over, I say, still mad at him for reasons I can't articulate. Two nights, at least.
This isn't a negotiation.
Why are you so against this?
Why are you so gung-ho about it? Jeff says.
She's a stranger, Quinn. She didn't even bother to tell you her real name.
I know her name. It's Samantha Boyd.
And she's not a stranger. She's a person who went through the same things I did, who now needs a place to stay.
We're in Manhattan, Jeff says. There are thousands of places she can go. Hotels.
I'm pretty sure she can't afford a hotel.
Jeff sighs, sits on the bed, kicks off his shoes. That alone should give you pause. Who travels from God knows where to New York without any money? Or any plan, for that matter?
Someone who's really upset about what happened to Lisa Milner and now wants to do something about it?
She's not our responsibility, Quinn.
She came here to see me, I say. That makes her our responsibility. My responsibility.
And I got those charges dropped. I think that's enough charity for someone we don't know.
Jeff shucks off his shirt, slides out of his pants, and crawls into bed, ready to put the whole night behind him. I remain by the door, arms crossed, sending out waves of unspoken anger.
Yeah, you did a swell job.
Jeff sits up, blinking at me.
Wait, you're actually mad at me for that?
I'm mad that you were so quick to play the victim card. All it took was one mention of the Nightlight Inn.
Sam didn't mind.
Only because she didn't hear you. I'm sure things would be different if she had.
I'm not going to apologize for keeping her out of jail.
Nor should you, I say. But you can at least acknowledge that there might have been a better way to do it. You should have seen the way that cop looked at Sam. Like she was a wounded dog or something. That's why she changed her name, Jeff. So people would stop pitying her.
But I'm angry at him for reasons that go beyond Sam. When he whispered to that cop, I caught a glimpse of Jefferson Richards at work. The lawyer. The guy willing to say anything to help his client, even if it meant reducing her to an object of pity. I didn't like what I saw.
Listen, Jeff says, reaching out for me. I'm sorry I did that.
But at the time, it seemed like the quickest way to resolve the whole thing.
I tighten my arms across my chest. If the roles were reversed, and it was me who had been arrested, would you have done the same thing?
Of course not.
I detect a streak of falsehood in his voice. There's a thinness to his words that brings the annoyed prickle back to my skin. I scratch my neck, trying to make it go away.
But that's what I am, right? I say. A victim? Just like Sam?
A frustrated sigh from Jeff. You know you're more than that.
So is Sam. And while she's staying with us, you need to treat her that way.
Jeff tries to utter another apology, but I cut him off by whirling around and throwing open the bedroom door. When I leave, I slam it shut so hard the walls shake. The guest room is small, tidy, stuffy. The red shade of the nightstand lamp throws a rosy glow over the walls. Because of the hour, everything feels shimmering and dreamlike. I know I should try to sleep, but I don't want to. Not with Sam seemingly wide awake, pulsing with heat and energy and life. so we huddle on the queen bed, shoes discarded on the floor, our feet shoved beneath the comforter for warmth. Sam retreats to the knapsack she dropped in the corner and removes